Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches the ball and it's strike three, you call the guy out. It's that simple, isn't it?
And if it's Monday, it's the knee jerks.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires. But you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with Attitude.
Attitude, OG! 1, 2, 3!
Attitude!
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports. The voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
It's Monday night, August 27th, 2012, 7 p.m., which means it's time for the Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm Big Al, otherwise known as Al Beaton of WayneFonts.com, the Wayne Fonts Experience, and BlessYouBoys.com. Bless you, boys. Every week I get together to talk with the man I call the voice of reason, Mr. Excitement, and, well, he knows a lot about sports, and that would be Mr. Greg Eno of GregEno.com. Greg, how's your week been?
Oh, lovely, Al. It's always good to be here with you every Monday night here in the Knee Jerks. Always a pleasure. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com. That's where you can read me every day of the week. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/GregEno, or simply at Greg Eno. You can also follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter. The kneejerks.info is the way to do that, or at the Knee Jerks. Our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, and our blog, the shortcut to our blog is thekneejerks.us, and in any of those social media sites, you can find out what's going on with the program, who the guests are going to be, and what we got cooking. Tonight, we are very pleased and happy to be joined by an old friend of the Knee Jerks, Mick McCabe, the son of Swami himself, longtime high school sports beat writer and columnist for the Detroit Free Press, will be with us tonight. We'll talk about a plethora of things, mostly school football related, because that's the season we're in right now. Mick will talk to us about the top teams in the divisions in the state, some of the top players to keep an eye out for, some of the differences that he's noticed covering high school sports now versus when he started about 40 years ago. So we'll cover that with Nick in a few minutes. And then Al and I will talk about the Lions and the Tigers and a bunch of other things. But right now, Al, it's we can't do any of that until we do. Whose birthday is it? Maestro, please. This game is played. I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual who's in the world of sports, whose birthday it is today, and then Al tries a guess, and Al will win a year's supply of Rice Aroni.
Oh, boy.
I got to change that. Every week I'm going to give you a different prize. I did Rice Aroni twice in two weeks in a row. I got to think of something else next week. This individual, Al, was born today, of course, in 1951. He's still alive. He was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His career was spent in Major League Baseball. He was drafted by the Cleveland Indians in 1969, which his big league debut 3 years later in 1972, which launched a career in which he got over 2,500 hits and was also the son of a big league player. So that's the first clue.
I'm just going to take a guess, since you're talking about sons and long careers and a guy who's not that much older. I'd say we would put him around 10 years older. How about Tom Petrarch?
Not Tom Petrarch. Nope, not Tom Petrarch. We will do clue number two after we get done with our guest, who is waiting for us right now. He's just McCabe of the Detroit Free Press, and let's get into the mix interview. Nick McCabe is an old friend of the Knee Jerks. He joined us a couple of years ago talking about high school football, and with the season upon us already, Al, believe it or not, they've already played one game. we thought it would be a good time to bring Mick back on the show. We're always happy to have him. Mick, thanks for being here tonight. We appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, guys.
Thanks a lot. Mick McCabe, the Son of Swami, the Son of Swami himself, is joining us here from the Detroit Free Press. Mick, this is, it just seems like these seasons just kind of, these football seasons just kind of sneak up on you. It's unbelievable to me that there's only been one game played. Two games are going to be played, essentially, before a lot of these kids are back to school and classes. So it's just funny how that works out. But you recently did a piece that was, I thought was very interesting on Al Fracassa, of course, the longtime football coach over at Brother Rice. And I've gotten a chance to meet him a couple of occasions, and I know you've talked to him, with him at length and for a number of years. How many years, first of all, has Al been at Brother Rice?
I believe this is like 43rd or 44th year, something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you have a high school coach like that, whether it's basketball, football, whatever, any sport, frankly, that when a guy is or a woman is at a school for that long, what kind of a legacy is that compared to a college coach or a pro coach? Is there something more to it, more special to you when a high school coach stays at one place, or where does that fall in the whole lexicon of longevity and legacies?
Well, I'd say it's a lot more special because he's not walking away a millionaire or a multimillionaire the way these college coaches are after they've been someplace for a long time. And I think you develop much better relationships with kids at the high school level than you do in the college level. And it's just a lot different and a lot better. And even though you don't have them, let's say, for 4 hours at practice a day, I mean, you have them in the classroom and you see them in different settings than a college coach sees his players.
Now, you did a piece on him recently, so obviously you spoke to him recently. Is the fire still there? Did you sense something that tells you that he's toward the end, or do you think he's still got some more years of coaching left in him?
Well, it's up to him because, I mean, he's 79 years old now, and that's getting up there. And he does have a ton of assistant coaches who do an awful lot for him, so he doesn't have to do anywhere near as much as he used to 20 years ago. That's for sure. But he still enjoys it. And, you know, it kind of, you become that. It kind of overwhelms you and takes over your life a little bit. And you don't know what you're going to do when you get out. And I think that, especially with the relationship he has with his assistants now, who are almost all former players of his, I think he feels very comfortable in the role he's got there now.
We're talking with Mick McCabe, the Son of Swami, the high school beat writer and columnist for the Detroit Free Press, listening to the Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com. And Big Al Outbeaten for the Wayne Fonts Experience. WayneFonts.com, of course, is here with us as well. Obviously, the season has started. One game is in the books, and which means we just came off of training camp and practice with these kids. And with the growing awareness, Mick, of concussions, certainly in the NFL and college as well, it seems to become a concussions is like the buzzword right now. Obviously, a lot of high-profile instances of players, of course, locally here in Detroit with Javid Best, and, you know, there's even in baseball, Paul Konerko, the great White Sox slugger, recently sat out about 5 games because of concussion. So there's been a lot of concussion-related stories in sports. What has been your observation about how high school programs are they getting on board with the whole concussion thing? I mean, what kind of awareness is going on out there right now in high school athletics when it comes to concussions?
Well, see, what's happened over the last 10 years is a lot of high schools have their own trainers, their athletic trainers, who are there for every practice and every game, and those people kind of take over. I mean, they're professionals, and they take over when someone gets hit in the head, and they're the ones who assume a lot of the responsibility, and it's they're the ones who tell a coach whether a kid can play or not. And that, I mean, back when I played, I mean, we were wearing helmets, nobody thought about concussions back then. And I'm sure a few of us had one too many in our day. And even like when Bo Schembechler coached in Michigan, I mean, as a player, you did not want to go into the training room because that was a kind of a show of weakness.
Kind of weakness, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember They used to pass out salt tablets to us when we were playing and told us to have those, and we weren't allowed to get drinks or water during practice because, again, another sign of weakness. So times have changed dramatically, and I think the best thing right now is most schools have their own trainers, and those people are trained professionals who know the signs of concussions and how to react to them, and they have the authority to tell coaches, hey, this guy's done for the day, and we're going to, you know, take a look, good long look at him before he puts on a helmet on again.
Al, you played high school football, I think, just after they got rid of a leather helmets, I believe.
Yes, but we did have face masks. That was a big deal, too.
Do you agree with Mick? When you played, in all seriousness, when you played, was there any sort of talk about that kind of thing, concussions or any sort of awareness about that?
No, absolutely not. None whatsoever.
Yeah, just what Mick says. There's nothing like that was going on. Yeah, when I was playing, all they did was you would pop salt tablets when it was really, really hot, and water was treated as a reward. Yeah. Not if you needed it or you weren't told to keep drinking. You were told you have to earn your water, keep running. So Mick's right on with that. And just to follow up with that, Mick, we were talking about how coaching has changed and how injuries are treated are changed. And all your time covering the beat, how have the kids changed? Have they become more sophisticated, different attitudes? Maybe you can go in a little detail with that.
Well, there are fewer kids playing football now, I believe, than in past years. I think Hazel Park the other day dressed like 21 kids.
Wow.
And Berkeley High School dropped freshman football. And none of those are good signs, for sure. I think there's so many more things now. Kids have options, so many more options than they did before. Kids are getting jobs now. I had a summer job, mm-hmm. but as soon as football practice started, you know, that was it.
Right.
Until, you know, if we didn't have a high school game on Sunday, then I'd go work the Lions games at Tiger Stadium. But, you know, that was it. Everything was, you know, high school football and stuff like that. But the biggest change of all are the parents.
Mm-hmm.
They're complete morons.
Good or bad change?
For the bad. They're imbeciles. Normal people become raving lunatics when it comes to their kids, and they think they deserve college scholarships. And if a kid doesn't get a college scholarship, naturally it's the coach's fault because their kid is perfect. And they don't know why they're not getting college scholarships. They don't realize that less than 2% of high school athletes receive any kind of scholarship, partial, full scholarship. They just don't realize that. They just think it's their God-given right. And if a kid doesn't get it, they will make their coach's life as miserable as they can for the rest of their lives. They will devote their lives to making that coach's life miserable.
Now, what do you suppose that is, Mick? And you say that it's gotten worse, because I remember when I played high school, Little League baseball, in my adolescent and early teen years, and I had always thought that it would have been a lot more fun if the parents weren't allowed to go to the games, and that was back in the mid-70s. So in what way has it gotten worse, and why do you think it's gotten worse?
Well, TV. Everybody watches TV, so now you're an expert. Now mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, I don't know why my kid's high school team isn't running the same offense as the Lions. You know, why didn't the quarterback and receiver do what Matt Stafford, you know, does to Calvin Johnson? It's so simple, and they explain things so well on TV. I mean, you know, people thought the Lions' former general manager was a genius when he was on TV until he got the Lions' job, and he proved to be a buffoon. But they make it sound so easy, and people see enough of it on TV, and they think they know something when they know nothing. And then, of course, college is so expensive now, so they want their kids to get a college scholarship. And parents today think their kids are perfect and never cause any trouble and, you know, should have the world handed to them. And that's not the way we were brought up. Their discipline in the home is just nowhere near what it used to be, and they expect the coach to be able to discipline them and things like that, and it's a mess. These parents are out of their minds. I had a softball coach in Grand Rapids tell me that after the first like three or four games, this one girl hadn't gotten the ball out of the infield. So he just used her on defense and had a DH for her. Well, by the end of the season, this girl was 1 for 28 at the plate, and the parent was furious that the kid didn't get a college scholarship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they're all nuts. They're all nuts.
Greg, if I could step in for just a second to follow up. As
absolutely.
We talk about the changes, one thing that, again, referring back to my high school sports days, I played three sports. I played football, basketball, and baseball. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm glad I did because I had a lot of fun and a lot of different exposure. It seems like now kids, they pick one sport early on in junior high, and then that's it. Do you think that has really hurt the quality of college sports in the state as well?
Well, I don't know. It's hurt high school sports.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
Sure. Yeah, and what happens is it's not so much as the kids picking a sport. It's their parents telling them, mm-hmm. we're going to focus on one sport. And, I mean, look at these 7-on-7s. This is ridiculous for football. As soon as the football season's over, boom, they're going to 7-on-7s, these passing leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting exposure. But these con men are running them, saying, we're going to get your kid a college scholarship. They're going to go all over the country, which they do. They run up thousands of dollars in bills, and some of these kids don't end up with anything. The one, Cooper Rush, a kid who passed the ball like crazy for Lansing Catholic last year, I asked him about it, and he goes, well, he went to 7-on-7, and boy, I got to play for George Arbery's team, and I got so much exposure. And, okay, how many college scholarships offers did you have? He goes, well, one. I said, where does Central Michigan, where he signed? He was getting a scholarship offered from Central, which is 45 minutes away from his school, whether he played 7-on-7s or not.
Mm-hmm.
What he did was flush away several thousand dollars. And so these kids go into the 7-on-7s and they give up basketball and they get hurt because you're using the same muscles over and over and over and they get fatigued and bones break and stuff like that. Muscles get pulled and you're so much better off by playing more than one sport. You never know what sport's going to turn out to be your best sport. And you'll never know it if you just pick one sport as a freshman in high school and you don't do any other sports.
We're talking with Mick McCabe, high school beat writer and columnist for the Detroit Free Press. The son of Swami is here with us tonight. You're listening to The Knee Jerks. I'm Greg Hino from GregHino.com, and you just heard Big Al Beaton from the Wayne Fonts Experience, WaynePonts.com. Mick, this has been, unfortunately, kind of a year of scandals in sports, both in pro and college, obviously the Penn State situation, the New Orleans Saints situation with the bounties. There's just been other stories where it's been, Melky Cabrera, Bartolo Colon. There's just been a lot of, unfortunately, negative stuff like that. And I know that you've done some investigative reporting as part of your job at the Free Press, and you've been, helped along by folks in the community and parents and coaches and what have you, and former players. I know you've written some exposés on some of the nefarious things that have gone on. In your illustrious history covering high school sports, is that part of the job a little bit different, or maybe taking more of your time than before? In other words, was there even investigative reporting in high school sports back then?
No, there wasn't back then, and now there is because schools are, some of them are just cheating like crazy. And the Michigan High School Athletic Association, they, if you ask them about it, and why aren't they looking into something, they go, well, we're not the FBI. And they live in Never Never Land there where they assume that everybody plays by the rules, and if you happen to break the rules, by mistake, well, then you self-report. Well, that's absolutely ridiculous. That
mm-hmm.
doesn't happen. I mean, there's so much recruiting going on in high school athletics now, it's disgusting. And the MHSA refuses to look into it unless you hand it to them on a silver platter. So, we have to do some of that stuff.
Now, is that, of all the things that's going on like that, all that negative, illegal, nefarious, whatever you want to call it, stuff, if you had to classify, would recruiting of athletes be by far and wide the number one bad deed that's going on right now? And if it is, what are some of the other bad deeds that are becoming more prevalent in your eyes?
Well, that's so far and above everything else. That's in its mm-hmm. own class. Nothing even comes close to going out and using undue influence to get kids to enroll as freshmen or get them to transfer as sophomores or anything like that. After that, then there's the out of season practices, illegal practices, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it still doesn't come. That's number one is the undue influence, and then you go the next one is about number 17. There's that wide of a gap between them.
Well, let's talk about something more positive. Obviously, the season is, as we indicated, is underway. Every team's played one game. My daughter's alma mater, Warren Mott, beat the crap out of Troy Athlin's.
It was kind of a surprise a little bit.
Yeah, they rushed for a ton of yards and what have you. Mm-hmm. But let's talk a little bit about, kind of go by division by division and
sure.
kind of run down some of the teams, Mick, are the teams to beat, so to speak.
Well, I think if we're going to start at the top, we go Division One, and Detroit Cass Tech yesterday beating Birmingham Brother Rice was a huge victory for Cass Tech. They're coming off winning the state championship last year. And a year ago, they were just as highly touted as they are this year, and they laid an egg in the opener and got killed by Harrison 43-7. Well, there are a lot of people thought that, that was going to happen again. And to Cass Tech, but they were ready. They fell behind 5-0, fumbled a pass early in the game, dropped a touchdown pass in the end zone. But they got it together and they played well, and they deserved to beat Brother Rice. And so right now they're still the best team in Division One. And Utica Eisenhower looked very, very good yesterday in beating Port Huron, a Port Huron team that had beaten them last year. So that was a big win for them. And of course Catholic Central in Novi is good, and Clarkston's good. So Dearborn Fortune beating Macomb Dakota was an impressive victory. But right now, Cass Tech is far and away the class of Division One. And in Division Two, Lowell beat Rockford. Now Rockford, their number one quarterback was out, didn't play, and then their backup quarterback got hurt, so they had to play a great deal of the game with their number three quarterback. But they played terrific defense at Rockford, and Lowell beating them was good and very impressive, and so was Muskegon beating Orchard Lake St. Mary's. And, of course, we've got Warren De La Salle with Shane Morris, the best player in the state. They beat Pioneer, and, of course, Midland came down and beat Canton. So those four teams are good in Division Two, but still Birmingham Brother Rice, even though they're 0-1, when push comes to shove, I think they're going to be the team that could win the state championship in Division Two. In Division Three, we kind of got a newcomer a little bit, Grand Rapids Christian. This is the next Country Day, the next Orchard Lake St. Mary's. They're putting a ton of money into athletics. They just built a new football stadium, a new gym. Brent Gates played for Oakland, Major League Baseball, as their baseball coach. They won a state title last year. Steve Marley, who won a state championship at Rockford, was on gave up coaching because of medical problems. Well, is much healthier now. Underwent surgery at Rush Hospital in Chicago. Is feeling really good now, and he's going to coach basketball. And Don Fellows is their football coach, and he's serious. And they're a team that they've got Drake Harris, who's a junior, who was offered by Michigan in football and basketball and committed to Michigan State and wants to play both. And I'm not sure what sport he's best in, which tells you an awful lot. So they're going to be really good in Division III along with DeWitt and Sturgis. And, of course, Orchard Lake St. Mary's, even though they're 0-1, is going to be a factor. And then Grand Rapids Catholic Central in Division IV opened up the other night by just trouncing each Grand Rapids. And they made everybody stand up and take notice there. And they won a state title 2 years ago. Catholic Central did. And so they're the team to beat there. And Croswell Lexington is another very good team in Division IV. In Division V, Jackson Lumen Christie beat Chelsea to open the season. And Lumen hasn't been a factor the last 2-3 years. Well, they're a factor now. And Flint Powers won the title last year, barely got in the state playoffs and won the title. And Kingsford from the Upper Peninsula is another team to keep an eye on in Division Five. And Ithaca in Division Six, I think they've won 29 games in a row now. Yeah, 29 games in a row. And they've got a junior quarterback named Smith, who was fabulous last year as a sophomore. And they're head and shoulders above everybody else there. Same thing in Division 7. It looks like another repeat for Sagar and Ovel, although Detroit, Loyola, and Hudson will be heard of from, and same with Reese. And then in Division 8, Mendon and Waterford, Lady of the Lakes are clearly the two best teams there.
Boy, Al, Mick just rattles these things off. Of course, we don't know if he's telling the truth or not, but I'm assuming he is. It's amazing how he's got that stuff stored in his head. Of course, that's part of, that's his job. That's what he's supposed to do. We'll talk with Mick McCabe, so Swami from the Detroit Free Press here on the Nature. So I'm Greg Eno from GregEno.com, and Big Al Alpeden, who we'll bring in a second, again, is with us from the Wayne Fonts Experience. How about some of the top players, Mick? And you just went over the schools, but who are some of the players, and who are the, what are the schools that the colleges of those guys are committed to?
Well, Shane Morris is the guy right now who looks like the best player in the state. He's a quarterback, 6'3", 202. He's at Warren De La Salle. He's a lefty, but he's very good. He made the Elite 11 camp this year. But the thing is, everything he's done so far has been without pads on. He's lit it up in all these camps, all these combines, and he has yet to do it in a game. He played well the other night, of course, when they beat Ann Arbor Pioneer. This is a big year for him. Now he needs to lead De La Salle to a championship, and we'll see if he will. Steve Elmer is a 6'6", 315 lineman from Midland, a two-way tackle, who was pretty impressive the other night when they beat Canton. And he's going to Notre Dame. Jordan Lewis is a defensive back wide receiver from Cass Tech who's going to Michigan, and he played very well for Cass Tech last night, and I assume he'll probably be a corner at Michigan, but he could be whatever he wants. And John Reschke, a linebacker from Birmingham Brother Rice, who also was impressive last night in a losing cause. He's like 6'3", 235. He's going to Michigan State. And he's got good speed, and he hits like crazy, and I really like him a lot. And then Gerald Holmes is a kid from Flint Cameron Ainsworth, a running back, who was hurt most of last year. Well, he came out and played very well when they upset Grand Blanc this past weekend. And now we know why Michigan State recruited him. Some people were wondering if he's good enough. Well, Mark D'Antonio does not make a lot of mistakes. I kind of look at him the way I looked at Lloyd Carr as far as evaluating kids, and Lloyd was one of the best evaluators of talent I'd ever known. I think Mark D'Antonio is exactly the same way, and I think that's why they're so successful. And then another kid I really liked last night, Thursday night, was Cameron Dillard. He's an offensive lineman from Canton. He's 6'3", and a half, 290, going to Florida. And he had a couple pancake blocks on Mr. Elmer. Now, Stephen was going both ways, so he was a lot more tired than Cameron was. But I was very impressed with Cameron, the way he's getting off the ball and going at the next level. You know, he'd brush by the one guy in front of him and then go and get a linebacker, too. And anytime you can do that, I think you're a big-time player. So those are some of the really good kids.
Let's talk about the big two, Michigan State and the University of Michigan, and how they've recruited in the state. First of all, kind of compare you obviously alluded to Mark D'Antonio, but kind of compare, Mick, if you would, Brady Hoke's focus on the state of Michigan versus what Rich Rodriguez did, or even going beyond Rich, what Lloyd Carr did. Is Michigan as a university, how hard are they hitting Michigan schools?
Well, they're recruiting like crazy. And what Brady Hoke did when he first got the job was very similar to what George Perlis did when he just really focused on the state of Michigan and took all the top names if he could get them. Now, the thing was, back then when Perlis did it, he got an awful lot of the top kids, but Michigan still had their choice of the top kids. Brady Hoke now is getting most of the really good players in the state of Michigan. He's taking more kids than Lloyd Carr did. That can go, it depends on the year, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Lloyd still, though, got most of the kids he wanted out of the state of Michigan. In fact, whenever we talked, my question was, who didn't you get that you really wanted from Michigan? And he was honest to a fault. He was terrific. I learned so much from him about evaluating players and things like that. And he was terrific. And I think Brady was smart in going after a lot of Michigan kids because there were some really good years when he first started. But Mark D'Antonio can go and the thing is he doesn't offer kids quite as early as Brady Hoke does. He wants to see them as much as possible before he offers them. And I think he would prefer it if there was no such thing as kids committing in their sophomore or junior year. And it was like the good old days where everybody waited until their senior year was over and then have a mad scramble. And I think he would prefer that even more. And I think to be honest, college coaches would be much better off if they did it that way, because now they're offering kids without ever having seen them play a down as a senior, sometimes without having played a down as a junior. And there's an awful lot of guesswork that goes with that stuff. And now, that's why college coaches get fired.
Now, does Hoke go into Michigan State's backyard and recruit the Lansing High Schools, and does D'Antonio venture into Ann Arbor to try to recruit the Ann Arbor, Washtenaw County kids, or no?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, anywhere in the States, there's no limits anywhere. Yeah, you can always... You always try and get the best players, no matter if they're in Lansing or Ann Arbor or wherever. Yeah, that's not an issue at all.
Got it. We're talking to Nick McCabe of the Detroit Free Press High School, writer and columnist. And let's bring Big Al back in the discussion from Wayne Ponce Experience. So, Big Al, what you got for Nick McCabe?
Yeah, I just wanted to – something that is kind of a big deal close to where I am. I'm up here in Lake Orion, and my girlfriend actually works for the Oxford School District, and there's a huge hullabaloo in Oxford over the football field they had installed at Oxford High School, where the parents actually put their houses up for – they put a second mortgage on all their homes to pay for it, and now the bill is due. And coming from someone whose girlfriend lost her job because Oxford schools privatized certain areas of their of the district, essentially people losing their jobs, yet the parents – decided that, well, no, let's not pay for a millage and save jobs. Let's use some money and get a football field. I guess it just kind of rubs me the wrong way when they do things like this. And I guess I just get your commentary on, again, it sounds like parents run amok and they got so out of control they actually put their houses up and are going to lose them.
Yeah, and it's terrible. It's a shame. And it's, people getting caught up in something like artificial turf, and we're going to make it blue, and it's going to be the only blue one in the state of Michigan, and oh my goodness, we can't wait to get it. And that's where somebody, the booster club president, somebody had to step back and say, wait a minute, we're not installing anything until this thing is paid in full.
Exactly.
And that was just a terrible error in judgment by those people, and it's going to ruin their lives forever. And because they're not going to be able to afford to live in Oxford anymore. And it's a shame. And, it's just, terrible thing. And, of course, athletics drives the bus quite a bit. And that's why a lot of back in the day when funding was a little different, they would always threaten to drop high school sports if a millage didn't go through, because they know that everybody wants their kids to be able to play athletics, and also those parents and kids are going to work to get the millage passed. So I thought it was really unfair, but that's what school districts did so often.
Before I move on to the next topic, I want to ask about a school right in your backyard, by where you reside, Allen Park High School. Always has been for years a top football program. I go back, of course, my days of television. We used to cover Allen Park a lot back in the days of Ed Bellis was the coach, and of course Tom Hoover took over and everything. And is Allen Park still a strong football team?
They won the other day, but they really struggled to beat Lincoln Park. But they're a public school, and it's not an open district where they take 25 school choice kids every year. So Tom Hoover is stuck with whoever walks in the door. And it's so unlike private schools, and it's unlike schools of choice that, advertise over the radio to try and get kids. And Tom doesn't have the opportunity to go out and try and recruit kids, legally or otherwise. So he's had a couple. They did make the state playoffs last year, but there have been some lean years. But, these things run in cycles, And hopefully things will recycle their way because he's an excellent football coach. He's a great offensive mind. And I really would love to see them very, very competitive again at the on the biggest stage.
It's been a few years now, Nick, since Michigan went to since they switched the girls' basketball season from the fall to coincide, run parallel, essentially, with the boys' season, the winter time. I know you weren't a fan of that when that first happened. Now that it's been in place for a few years, are you even more now a fan, or are you buying into it, or are you still very opposed to it?
No, it's a total disaster. I had a coach tell me that he was cleaning something out of his attic and found something wrapped in a newspaper, and in it was a column I had written before this actually started, and I said, this is what's going to happen. And everything's happened, and it was all bad. And he said every single thing you said would come, you know, that would happen has come true. The attendance is down in both boys and girls. College scholarships are down with girls. Girls basketball is gotten far less publicity than they did before, and it's hurt volleyball immensely. They used to have these weekend tournaments at colleges all over the state for volleyball during the winter. Well, you know, despite what these parents think, nobody wants to sit in a gym in September when it's hot, when Michigan and Michigan State are playing football.
Right.
They just don't want to do it. And colleges who are hosting college football games that weekend, they don't want to host these volleyball things because they got too much other stuff going on, and it's a mess with parking and everything. So it has really hurt volleyball tremendously, as much as it's hurt girls basketball, and it was strictly a lose-lose proposition.
And it's exactly turned out to be a lose-lose proposition.
Right, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, that's too bad. I'm not even going to go into whether or not they'll change it because that's another whole other discussion. But let's talk instead about before. Yeah, well, let's talk about, before I let you go, I want to ask you, in your long history of covering high school sports in the state of Michigan, just, you know, off the top of your head, who are like maybe your top five greatest high school athletes, regardless of sport, top five greatest high school athletes you've had the pleasure of covering in your years?
Well, Tyrone Wheatley jumps out. He was just a terrific football player. Everybody knows that, two-way player. But he was – a referee told me that he was refereeing one of their games, and Tyrone took off like a foot inside the free throw line and dunked. And he said, the whistle dropped right out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a one-man track team, almost won a state championship team state championship by himself as a junior. He was a terrific sprinter, and he's a wonderful kid. He was a kid I thought could go either way. I mean, you know, his dad was murdered, his mom was on drugs, living with his aunt and uncle in this really small house, and he just didn't know what was going to happen. But this was a kid with great conviction, and there was something. He had a moral compass, and he's turned out to be a wonderful young man. So he's the greatest. I don't know if anybody remembers Jim Pachorek.
Sure.
Played at Orchard Lake St. Mary's, won a state football championship at Orchard Lake, won a basketball state championship there, and his best sport was baseball, was an All-American at Michigan, and got to the major league level. And there's no doubt in my mind he could have been an NFL player. They eventually moved him to tight end, and he would have been just like Bruce Hardy from Utah, who wound up playing for years with the Miami Dolphins. And I think Jimbo could have done that had he chosen to stay there. I remember Gary Danielson was a terrific athlete, an outstanding football player, but he was really a good basketball player too. You know, Paul Tarek was a kid from Livonia, Stevenson, who ended up being a decathlete, the Olympics, and obviously a terrific all-around athlete there too.
Right.
Those are the kids who immediately come to mind.
Didn't we get into coaching?
Who did?
Tyrone Wheatley. Did he get into coaching?
Yeah, he's an assistant coach at Syracuse. Yep.
Yeah, that's what I saw. Yeah, yeah.
Football
that's,
assistant there. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's always good to see, you know, in doing this high school players, not just in Michigan, just all over the country, who either go back to their alma mater as coaches or just coach high school sports, whether it's their alma mater or not. And these are guys who've had, you know, experience on the biggest stage, whether it's the NFL or Major League Baseball or what have you, NBA. And it's really neat to see big-name, high-profile former athletes go back, to, at least in my mind, to go back and give back to a high school community or what have you as a coach. I think that's just great. I love that.
Yeah, and that's exactly what Tyrone did, because he went back to Robichaud. And I was at his first practice, and I'm thinking, Tyrone, my man, what did you get yourself into? I figured they were going to be 2-7 tops, and they ended up making a state playoffs.
Reminding of Ronnie Adams, who went back to Taylor and coached which Taylor school did he coach?
He coached at Taylor Center.
Right, yeah,
And now he's at Wyandotte. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. He always hold a big a soft spot of my heart because he led my alma mater to the California Bowl in 87.
Yeah. In fact, I covered that. In fact, he coached at Taylor Truman because Taylor Center had closed. But I remember in 1984 when they tried throwing Eastern out of the MAC, I was there the day the freshman reported, and he was one of the freshmen. And I said, well, what do you know, they tried throwing you out of the league. You know, how do you approach this? He goes, well, I want to come in here, win a championship for Eastern. I'm thinking to myself, this kid must be on drugs because they were pathetic back then, but he was a guy.
Right.
He won the MAC title and won the California Bowl.
Yep, absolutely. You can still, Eastern still hasn't had really the success since then that they had in 87 with Harkema and Adams and those guys. And I remember Steve Avery, when covering him when he was a skinny basketball and baseball player, Taylor Kennedy, and then look what he became. I remember talking to him, and you did a nice, really nice article, by the way, about he and his kid, who was born prematurely. And I remember talking to Steve when he was still pitching in the big leagues about how our daughter was premature. I was giving him some advice and some words of wisdom about that. And I saw your piece about his kid and this big smile on his face and brought tears to my eyes, that article about how. Because it was a very personal experience that I had as well, and to see Steve, you know, with his kid and everything, that was great. And of course, his dad was an athletic director at
his dad pitched in the Tigers organization.
Right. Another great athlete that came out of Michigan, Steve Avery. He could have been a college basketball player, maybe. He was
for sure. There's no question. Because I went to cover them. First game of the district, they were playing against the Wayne High School, and a buddy of mine was a scout with Seattle Mariners, and he went there just to see Steve, how he competed against pure athletes from Wayne Memorial, and there was no question Steve was the best athlete on the court that day.
We have been talking with Mick McCabe. Unfortunately, our time has run out. Mick, of course, you can read him at the Detroit Free Press, freep.com, if you go online and read his stuff about high school sports. And I like when you get opinionated, and I like when you get a little investigative because they call some of these schools out. And I like reading about how the reaction to you're kind of like the 60 minutes of high school.
Well, Mick, thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy time of the year to talk to us, and hopefully we'll have you again, at least quicker than 2 years anyway.
Okay, anytime, guys.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mick, we appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Mick McCabe, longtime Free Press High School beat writer and columnist, also known as the son of Swanee, who makes all those fearless predictions of all the high school games every week, and especially when it comes down to March Madness and the pro football, high school football playoffs. Mick McCabe has been our guest here in the New Jersey. Always good to talk to Mick McCabe, Al. He's a walking encyclopedia of high school sports. I got a kick out of how he was just rattling off all those teams and the divisions and how good they are. And it's funny because a lot of those names are schools that you hear a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
They're always, traditionally good, but it's just so funny to hear. And I know that's his job, but to just hear how he just rattles them off like that, these schools that are in the, everywhere from the Boondocks to Metro Detroit, it was pretty fascinating. So always good to talk to Mick. Al, we got lots of go. We've got about an hour left in the program. I want to do clue number two of whose birthday is it?
It's fire away. Go for it.
Okay. The first clue, of course, is I was born in 1951. I was the son of a big league player. I made my big league debut in 1972 with the Cleveland Indians, a career in which I garnered over 2,500 hits. I was a 5-time All-Star. I was a 6-time Gold Glover. And I am inducted into the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame.
Texas Rangers Hall of Fame. Let's see. Son of a guy. This is something I should have, because I know the Texas Rangers Hall of Fame stuff came up a lot in the Detroit area with the was it with Pudge Rodriguez and Kenny Rogers and them being inducted into their Hall of Fame. But I'm trying to Buddy Bell.
Good. Yeah. Buddy Bell is 61 today. Buddy, of course, managed the Tigers for a couple of seasons, two seasons. He also managed Colorado. He managed Kansas City. He's managed over 1,200 big league games. Not a lot of success as a manager, but he had a lot of bad teams, too. He played for Texas, obviously. Played for the Indians, played for Cincinnati, played for Houston. Of course, his dad, Gus Bell, the big time outfielder for the Pittsburgh Pirates, and that's why Buddy was born in Pittsburgh, because when he was born, his dad was playing for the Pirates. So Buddy Bell is 61 years old today. Happy birthday, Buddy. Okay, so let's get into our what you got on the agenda.
Oh, mostly Lions and Tigers, because the Lions had their third exhibition game, and it didn't go very well. It was a ton of injuries, a bunch of, a lot of mistakes, and they pretty much had their rear ends handed to them by the Oakland Raiders. Even though Mikel LeSure finally made his first appearance as a Detroit Lion. And Kellen Moore has pretty much locked up the third-string quarterback position, but we'll talk a little bit about all that. In baseball, the Tigers took two of three from the Los Angeles Angels of California, of Anaheim, whatever you want to call them. Actually, not a bad homestand for the Tigers, Greg. They were 6-3. Annabelle Sanchez actually started to pitch like the pitcher we thought he was going to be. But there's still some issues with the lineup, and obviously there was more shenanigans in Major League Baseball between a major blockbuster trade with the Dodgers taking on, I think, the GNP of Europe in contract off of the Boston Red Sox, and another suspension for PEDs that would be Bartolo Colon. Pretty much, I think this is going to end his career, as he got popped for 50-game suspension for and performance-enhancing drugs. But, Greg, since we were talking a lot of football with Mick McCabe, why don't we stick with football and we'll go with the Lions. Exhibition number three is in the books. Actually, it was funny. I was talking about it Sunday afternoon. I was asked to be on a podcast, NFC Central podcast, with, all English guys. I was the only American. Amazing enough, it was really funny that they're – they had a Bears fan and a Packers fan and a Vikings fan, and they were all based in Great Britain. It was a lot of fun, and I almost needed – the only thing is I almost needed subtitles. But it worked out pretty cool, and I think I may do a little bit more of them. But they like the Lions. They think the Lions are going to have a decent year, even though exhibition number three was pretty ugly. And there were some red flags, Rick, with that exhibition game. Specifically, Carson Palmer and especially Terrell Pryor tore him up. And Pryor, not so much of his arm, but once again, just like last year when the Vikings, I forgot the kid's name, the backup for the Vikings, who did the same exact thing. He was a running quarterback and just ran wild. Terrell Pryor did the same thing. He was unstoppable. Grant had 90 yards rushing in limited time. But, again, it's only one game, and it's only an exhibition game. And thank goodness the guys, there are some injuries that don't look to be too severe. But is there anything we can take from an exhibition game, even though the pundits like to say, well, this is a dress rehearsal. This is the closest thing to a regular season game you'll see all preseason is game number three, because they game plan it like it's a regular season game. They treat it like a regular season game, you know, the drill. But still, it's an exhibition, doesn't count. But the Lions didn't play well. No running game to speak of, even with LeSure on the field. And there were some defensive faux pas. The cornerbacks struggled. So should we be worried, Greg, should we just ignore it being an exhibition? Or is the truth of the matter somewhere in the gray in between?
Well, it's probably somewhere in the gray in between. Though I do lean heavily toward the fact that exhibitions don't, whether you want to consider this a dress rehearsal or not. And really, the only reason they say that is because the starters typically play the most in the third game than they play of any game, because they don't play very much at all in the fourth game, if at all in the fourth game. And so the third game is, as far as playing time goes, that's where you'll see the starters probably stay in longer, probably sometimes even into the second half, depending on the coach and depending on what kind of premium that coach wants to place on that particular game. But, I think that you mentioned the running quarterback situation. I know that Cam Newton, of course, Cam Newton did a lot of damage to a lot of teams last year. The Lions had trouble with Cam Newton last year a little bit when the Carolina came into town. But that's what those guys do. The Lions aren't going to be the only team that Terrell Pryor is going to do that too if he plays. I mean, you know, obviously he's got to beat out Carson Palmer, but you know, any running quarterback. I mean, these running quarterbacks out, they can make you look bad in spurts and short periods of time. I don't know what their shelf life is or what their longevity is in terms of. You know, there really hasn't been since Randall Cunningham really, and even Randall didn't really win anything, so to speak.
Right.
There really hasn't been since Steve Young has there been really. By the time Steve Young won a Super Bowl with the 49ers, he was on the back end of his career. He'd done a lot of his running earlier on when he played the champ and when he played in the USFL. He was still mobile, of course. But, you know, at that point, he was more of, I think, an all-around quarterback. There really hasn't been a quote-unquote running quarterback who's really won anything in the NFL. So, you know, I know that these guys can make you look bad, and certainly Pryor did that to the Lions Saturday night. The secondary got tortured a little bit. But, again, you know, a lot of the damage that Pryor did was against non-starters, although there were a few starters on the defensive line. But in the secondary, there weren't a lot of starters, if any, left by the time that Pryor entered the game. I think that the Lions are going to be – I mean, I'm not worried. I mean, I'm not concerned. They moved the football a little bit. I mean, you know, Sean Hill did a little bit of – he moved the team a little bit, and Stafford – he was okay, and what you're just trying to do out in these games, you're just trying to stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Stafford went out, and everybody's heart went into the throat for a second, but it was a non-throwing hand injury and not very serious. And you know, Bentley was hurt, and a couple of the guys got nicked up, but you know, I mean, that's what you're trying to do, just survive it. You know, you win, you lose, you lose. Coaches, of course, are going to find all sorts of things on film that they can. You know, nitpick to death, because that's what coaches do. But for the layperson, for the average fan, I think that this was just something that the Lions, you know, you get out of town, you leave, you end the game pretty much as healthy as you started it. No serious injuries. Nobody seems to be out for any length of time. You worked on some things. You didn't, you know, you certainly didn't break out your entire playbook. You know, that you just don't do that because you don't want to give other teams anything to look at on film from the exhibition season that might show your hand. So it's just another, you know, just a drill to get out of town healthy, and they did that. They did look good at times, but, you know, again, let's face it, this was not a game that counts in the standings, and that has a lot to do with how the game was played.
Yeah, well, I'd be more worried if it was week one or two of the regular season than week three of the exhibition season, say at the very least. And yeah, I was with you. I was trying to, I was racking my brain there trying to think of a running quarterback that really seriously had a long term, a career of winning titles, as you said. And Steve Young always comes to mind. And I'm with you. I always thought of him more as a quarterback who could run instead of a running quarterback, if you know the difference. And, Cam Newton may end up being a quarterback that breaks the mold. But, again, the NFL is a totally different animal. And as good as the years he had last year, he's got to prove to follow up. And you could say the same, actually, about following up on a big year. You could say the same about Matthew Stafford. And that kind of brings us to injuries. Stafford had to leave the game after hitting his hand on a helmet. Also, it was interesting. The reason Stafford got hit is because Mekhi Lashore, making his first start at the Lions, missed a block. And that's one of the problems by head coaches. Always get a little worked up over playing rookies in the backfield because of mistakes like that. Speaking of Lashore, in the game about injuries, his night ended with his midsection wrapped for some mysterious reason. There was really no reasons as to why, but he was hurt for some reason. Bill Bradley, the rookie who's been making quite an impression, he hurt his shoulder. Chris Houston, who the Lions are going to lean on in a big way, his cornerback position, he left the game with an ankle issue. And guess what? Kevin Smith, he had an ankle issue as well. The wind must have changed and hit him in the wrong direction. But I think the only one that really had me worried, Greg, was Matthew Stafford. Obviously, for obvious reasons, but it was just one of those things where it seemed like every other, you know, I had both games on because I was covering the Tigers game for Bless You Boys, and I had the Lions game on a secondary screen, so I didn't have my complete attention on it all the time. But it seemed like every time I turned my head to to see what's going on in the Lions game. A line was being was laid up on the field. A line was wrapped up on the sidelines, specifically Stafford, who had his hand literally mummified immediately. And it kind of brings out the as much as we'd like the Lions' chances this year, Greg, seeing all these injuries, it once again reminds you, as vastly improved as this team is, they are not at all very deep. And if they start losing guys like this, specifically guys like Houston, who is going to be a big piece of the defense, Bradley has really made an impression, and obviously two running backs go down, it really goes to show that this is not a very deep team, at least not yet.
Well, it depends on what position you're talking about.
Exactly. The defensive line is one thing. Running back's another. You're right.
Yeah, I think they're pretty deep on offensive line, too. I think they've got some guys that can move in and out, Dylan Gandy and of course, Riley Reiff, who, I had mixed reviews on him as watching, keeping an eye on him in the second half. I was kind of just watching him specifically in a few plays. And also I saw a shot of Ndamukong Suh with his left knee wrapped in
iced
or a bandage or something, and he was limping on. But, they didn't even talk about him as far as an injury, so that must have been really minor. Maybe that was just a bruise or something. But, the thing about these exhibitions is that because you play football, one of the worst things you can do as a football player is not play at full speed.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the worst things you can do. That's where you can really, really set yourself up for injury. But the ironic thing about that, of course, is that it is a game that doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't – you don't want to necessarily put your – it's easy to think like that as a player. This game doesn't count, especially if you're a guy who's got a starting position locked up. You're not battling anybody. So, and certainly Stafford's injury was not a result of him going half speed, for sure. But just playing the game of football, as you have to play it at a high motor, because – when you don't, that's really when you're most susceptible to injury. And people talk a lot about these guys who lay their bodies out and give up their bodies that they play so hard. But really, the guys who get hurt are the ones that maybe don't, it just takes just a moment of indiscretion where you're not going to go full speed. And that's when you're more vulnerable to getting hit or to rolling an ankle or something happening to you or not being aware of what's going on around you. And maybe you get a helmet on the knee or something. There's just a lot of things that can happen in the game of football. But, I think that, for the most part, the Lions, survive this. And that's what you're trying to do. And, I didn't like, a lot of things I didn't like, of course, about the game. But on the other hand, the Raiders have got a lot of guys who are, they got a new coach. They got a lot of guys trying to, jostling for roster spots. They got the prior situation. Maybe they just had a little bit more, maybe their motor was a little bit higher than the Lions were, frankly. You're out there on the road. You're just trying to get out of it. You're playing on a surface, Al, which is the only remaining surface, I believe, in the NFL that doubles as a Major League Baseball stadium. I think that's the only one left is Oakland. And so that doesn't help either. They used to talk a lot about the old veteran stadium in Philadelphia and how bad that turf was and other stadiums around, even the Silverdome and how hard that surface was. But really, these football stadiums that are played in baseball parks, which, there's only one left, those weren't any cup of tea either. When you played in Cleveland, you played in Oakland, you played in the old Tiger Stadium, you played in a lot of these places that doubled at big league baseball parks. Those were not fun surfaces to play on by any stretch of the imagination. You got the infield there. It's just not. It's just different. And that's where I remember Dan Marino went down with his Achilles injury, which opened the way for Scott Mitchell back in 1993. Happened in Cleveland on a part of the playing surface that was in between the infield and the outfield. So these kind of things, that didn't help either. But bottom line is, none of these guys that you mentioned, I don't think, are going to miss. I think we'll all be ready for opening day,
Stafford is already on record saying he will be fine, and it's looking that way for the remainder of the walking wounded, so to speak. It's probably, as you said, it's probably one of those things, being it is still an exhibition game, even if they prepared for it like a regular season game, and they aren't going to risk it. These guys may have tried to tough it out if it had been a regular season. So, but still, trust me, I was holding my breath there a couple times when I saw the guys go down like they had been shot. But luckily, nothing looks too serious, so they dodged a bullet. All right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the offense. And a couple of disturbing things about this game was, one, that the Lions' first-team offense seemed to be settling for field goals. And that, I think, kind of leads to the rushing game. They only had one first down rushing. They only averaged 2.7 yards per carry. And I think Mikel Lesher, who made his big debut, ran hard, but only had five carries for 1 yard. I think most of this, though, Greg, really falls on the offensive line. And it's no shocking thing to any Lions fan that the Lions have built an offensive line that I think is awesome at pass blocking, because, once again, the Lions didn't have too much trouble throwing the ball, and Matthew Stafford, before he got hurt, was having a solid game. But when it comes to running the ball, they're still having issues making holes for guys. And as much as a workhorse we're hoping Lesher will end up being, he still needs at least a small crease to get through. And once again, he was having to make moves in the backfield before even reaching the line of scrimmage, and that does not add up to a very good running game. So overall, I was pretty disappointed in the running game, but then again, I wasn't surprised either.
No, I mean, it wasn't a surprise. I mean, I guess maybe a surprise would have been if they had gone out there and really, run the ball down the Raiders' throats. But You know what? I mean, I wrote on GregNeal.com that, you know, I don't want to see the Lions run the football for the sake of running it.
Oh, yeah.
If they don't have the personnel to run the football. I mean, you know, I took some flack on it. Some people said, well, you know, you really should strive for balance. And I said, look, in a perfect world, you would. You'd get 4 yards on first down with a rushing play every time. But, you know, the Lions aren't built like that. They don't have there's not a good mix right now. Their running back situation is very, very – it's filled with question marks, whether it's because of injury or because of inexperience or just guys that just don't have a lot of – long resumes as NFL running backs. There's a lot of reasons to look at the running game and have question marks before you even try to run the football. The blocking, the funny thing about that, Al, is that most offensive linemen will tell you that they much prefer run blocking than they do to pass blocking. It's it's an opportunity for them to really flex their muscles as linemen, to really make that big block. Nobody remembers too much pass blocks, but they do remember great running blocks. There's a certain sense of pride about run blocking. Unfortunately, the Lions just haven't been able to, you know, really cohesively. And it's funny because really, if you look at their line, for the most part, those five guys have played together for about 3 or 4 years now.
Right.
And usually that's what makes a good offensive line, is that cohesiveness and that longevity, if you will, of playing next to each other and trusting the guy next to you. Very few people, I shouldn't say very few, but a lot of people who follow pro football don't realize, and you know this because you played football, but people who watch the game don't realize how it's like defense in the NBA. You have to have trust in your teammates. You have to have trust in the other guy. Everybody's just got to do their job. If one guy tries to do somebody else's job on that line, that's where you can run into problems. And you just have to trust your line mate that he's going to do his job. And you got to do your job, and whether you're scheme blocking or blocking zones or blocking gaps, you have to just do your thing. And you know, the Lions just haven't been able to find that mix out of a cohesive running. A lot of it, frankly, Alex, because they haven't had consistency at running back. I mean, that's been a position that just has not, for whatever reason, it's been just, and I hate to go back to Barry Sanders, I hate to talk about the past so much, but really since Barry left in 1999, the Lions have really struggled to find a go-to back. They thought they had it a little bit with James Stewart, and then he hurt his shoulder and couldn't play anymore, and then they thought they had it with Kevin Jones, and then he had a basically career-ending injury, and they brought in other guys like Artus Pinner and other guys that they thought we had some potential. They just haven't been able to find, even the guy from Michigan State, they brought Duckett. They haven't been able to really find anybody who can be that guy. Now, the thing is, we talked about how in the NFL today, maybe you don't need a guy that's going to carry the football 20, 25 times a game. But there hasn't been really, Alex, this whole thing has been done by committee. And you look at the running back core now, they're just full of question marks, and is he going to be healthy? What do we have with this guy? You look at every running back on that roster right now, there's really nobody that you can point to with confidence and say, we know what we're going to get from fill in the blank. There really isn't. You
no.
can't look at Mikel LeShore and say that. You can't look at Kevin Smith and say that. You can't look at Keelan Williams and say that. You can't look at Joyke Bell and say that. You can't look at Stephon Green and say that. You can't look at anybody on that roster that runs the football and say, we're going to get X out of this guy, because they're all question marks. And, of course, that's not even talking about Jahvid Betts.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness there's no question marks at quarterback or wide receiver or tight end. Thank goodness. And again, that drives the point home, is that there's a reason this team is unbalanced offensively, because all the talent is on the outside and at quarterback. So it's it would be silly, as we talked about last week, to have balance for the sake of balance. You're right. As much as we all would love to see a running game, as we were spoiled for a decade by Barry Sanders, the Lions need to do what they do best. And as much as it frustrates me to see this team struggle to convert like third and short, well, if that means instead of running the ball, they throw it to Calvin Johnson instead, I think I can live with that. Defensively, Greg, secondary didn't play all that well, specifically the cornerbacks. They got burned a few times. They were missing Lewis Delmas in the secondary, who was obviously going to be out for the rest of the season due to his having knee surgery. Once again, Willie Young was, well, the kick ass. You know, he had a marvelous interception where he just stuck his big old paw out and just nabbed the ball out of the air while he was rushing the passer. Yeah, he is really a marvelous, marvelous athlete, and I love watching the kid play. He's they say, he's when he does makes plays. You know, that's what you want out of a defensive end. And other than that, you know, you were right about with Terrell Pryor. I remember watching a few plays. And I could even see it happening, specifically the two plays where Pryor had one long run, and then he ran into the end zone after that. And you could see it happening immediately, because you could see the defensive end, wasn't a starter. You could see him start to go in, because he saw Pryor looking to scramble, and he would step up in the pocket. You'd see the defensive end lose contain. And that's the last thing he needs to do, because all of a sudden he got sucked in, decides to go start moving towards the center, and Pryor was gone right around the end. So that's the kind of stuff that bothers me, and hopefully that's the sort of stuff we won't see on defense. And again, I don't think that's the sort of stuff we're going to see from Cliff Avril and Willie Young and Kyle Vandenbosch. But again, we have to take all this with a grain of salt, like you said, just because of the defense is still missing guys. And the people we did see make mistakes were not starters.
Well, you know, when you face a running quarterback like Pryor or Cam Newton or whoever else you want to mention, you have to have good play from your defensive ends, because typically what happens is that when these guys start running around, where do they start running first? To the outside.
Right.
They don't typically, their first run of choice, their first scramble of choice, if you will, usually isn't back up the gut between the tackles. It's usually when a guy is rolling out, or they start to roll out, it's just the outside. You mentioned contain. If you've got athletic guys, though, like Young on the bookending the defensive line, guys who can move laterally, and it's so important to be able to do that, and the guys who can chase people down, that means all the difference in the world. If you don't have speed on your defensive end positions, and people talk a lot about speed at outside linebacker, and that's important too, of course, in the running attack. But when you're going up against a quarterback, the other thing too, Al, is these running quarterbacks that they have nowadays, you know, it used to be in the days of Greg Landry or Bobby Douglas or some of those running quarterbacks back when you and I first started watching.
Oh, Bobby Douglas. Oh, you get a plus one for that one, Greg.
Well, these were smaller. I mean, you know, probably even they weren't small, but they were definitely, you could tell that they were quarterbacks by their size compared to, now they were, you know, Greg Landry, they were tall. I mean, they weren't shrimps, but they were not the big, strong cut. You look at guys like Cam Newton when they're not in uniform, or even when they are in uniform. These are big guys. I mean, you know, Terrell Pryor's got some size. These are not, you know, 185-pound quarterbacks like they were back in the day. These are, you know, 240-pound quarterbacks with speed who are bouncing off of would-be tacklers, like a running back would do. So these guys that are running around back there, they're not these – I mean, they're big guys. And you have to have strong linemen who are fast and can bring these guys down because, you know, a cornerback is not going to tackle these cornerbacks anymore. You know, these cornerbacks that are playing in the NFL now are not big enough, Al, to bring these big running quarterbacks down by themselves. That you have to have help from these guys, your linemen who are running laterally along the line of scrimmage, and not only running laterally, but who can change from up rushing upfield to on a dime changing, you know, like a transmission, changing to now I'm going to go east west and try to chase this guy down if he runs free out of pocket. So these are you have everything's athletic now. The linemen have to be athletic. The quarterbacks now are more and more athletic, and because of the size and speed that these guys combine, and prior on that long touchdown pass, it was impressive of how his arm strength, how he just kind of flicked that ball out there and led that receiver in perfect stride after rolling to his right and just kind of flying across his body like he was throwing a little nerf football. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Yeah, you're right. That is one of the changes in the quarterback position where the most talented guys just have monstrous arms, as we see with the Lions and Matthew Stafford, who I swear could throw a football through a brick wall. And speaking of quarterbacks, before we as we wrap up our Lions topics for today, that would be the Lions have apparently settled on a third-string developmental quarterback. And for the first time in ages, they actually have a guy who isn't exactly – wouldn't call a reject or someone's pet backup quarterback, going back to the Mike Morris era. And that is, Kellen Moore. The Lions waived R.J. Archer. And apparently have settled on Kellen Moore as the developmental quarterback. And watching him play, what little bit I've seen him play in the exhibition season, he is definitely a developmental quarterback. There's a lot of work to be done there. I guess the question is with Moore, you know, you do see the talent there. I mean, the guy is a winner. He had a marvelous career at Boise State. I guess the question is, do you risk trying to put him on the practice squad, which means putting him on waivers, or do you hold on to him and put him on the roster as a third quarterback? Because realistically, the Lions don't need three quarterbacks if they're confident in the health of Matthew Stafford and Sean Hill. They are both established, legitimate winning NFL quarterbacks. So I guess that's the question, Greg. Do you use a roster spot on a developmental quarterback who is not going to see the field unless it's absolute catastrophe? Or do you risk losing him and hope you're able to put him on the practice squad?
Well, you know, that's a good question. You know, the thing about Moore, though, he's not the same type of quarterback that neither Stafford or Sean Hill are. He's more, to me, he reminds me more of a West Coast offense quarterback. He seems like he's more suited to the short passing game.
He doesn't have the arm that Stafford does.
But who does? But he doesn't have – he probably has a below-average NFL arm as of right now.
Right.
You know, Matthew Stafford is very young. Sean Hill is not very young, but he's not ancient either.
Right.
He's in between. So it's not like you're grooming anybody to become the next quarterback, because Stafford, we hope, is going to be here for another 10 years. Hill is a very capable backup who can win – who can win, has won games in the NFL, and has won games for the Lions, and probably will continue to win games if he's put in a position to do so. You know, I don't know, Al, if you're really risking a whole lot by putting Moore on the practice squad, because I don't know right now at this stage how attractive he is to other teams in the NFL. I know, like you said, he comes from Boise State, which clearly is known as having a very high-octane, you know, pass-happy offense in the college ranks and teams that have been in the top 10, of course, nationally. But I don't know that he, Moore, is someone that – I mean, I could be wrong, but I don't know if the Lions are really risking a whole lot by doing that. And if they do and that happens, well, again, you know, this is a guy that probably you don't ever want to think your number three quarterback is going to play anyway, period. And so it's not something that you don't think – you know, certainly you won't be able to go out and find another one. I don't know how – much they believe in this kid. I mean, the Archer thing, you know, that didn't really impress me because I didn't think Archer was going to be kept anyway.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know that you know how sold they are on this Moore kid. I mean, obviously, they are to the degree they drafted him, but as far as a long-term option, sometimes these guys, Al, as you know, they start out with one team and kind of hone their skills and learn, and they end up becoming stars for other teams. You know, look no further than Brett Favre, of course, who was essentially a number three quarterback for the Falcons before he became what he became with the Packers. And, you know, sometimes these guys are like, well, Drew Stanton now. Drew Stanton has gone on to the Jets. You know, and by all what I've read is done well. It's been impressive over there. So, you know, sometimes these guys just go elsewhere. So it may be that Kellen Moore never does play for the Lions and ends up playing for some other team.
Yeah. And don't forget, Stanton is actually with, he moved on to the Colts as the, when they traded for Tim Tebow, he says, I want out of here.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that. Right.
Well,
the Colts.
He
right.
Playing time with, I have a feeling that he may end up seeing some playing time behind Andrew
right.
Luck being
right.
the rookie.
That's right. That's right. Because Drew Stanton requested a trade when they got Tebow. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. But because that was just kind of hilarious, as they say. Just I felt bad for the kid, to say the very least, saying, "Oh, the Jets want me," and also, no, I guess no, they don't. But all right, let's move on and talk a little. Let's start with Major League Baseball first, just because we got to talk about the blockbuster trade before we get to Tigers. And Greg, I was actually flabbergasted that the Red Sox were able to pawn off an amazing amount of contracts and one injured player on the Dodgers.
Right.
But here's the details. The Dodgers, they get some very well-known names and take on well over $260 million in contracts. And that's on top of some of the deals they've already picked up, such as Hanley Ramirez, I believe I read somewhere right now. Since the trade deadline up to now, the Dodgers have picked up over $400 million in guaranteed money they have to pay. But this trade contained Adrian Gonzalez, the first baseman, who recently signed a long-term deal with the Red Sox like just a year ago after they signed him as a free agent. Right-hand pitcher and a guy who caused a big ruckus over his love of chicken and beer in a clubhouse, and that was Josh Beckett.
Mm-hmm.
They also traded for Carl Crawford, who signed for major free agent money last year and has been hurt. Now is had to have Tommy John surgery and probably won't even be ready to play till sometime next year. And the man Tiger fans love to hate, Nick Punto. And the Red Sox essentially received a bunch of prospects and a slap-hitting first baseman, and not very productive one at that, in James Loney. The trade was approved by Commissioner Selig. So the Dodgers, it's funny, Craig, a year ago we were talking about how the Dodgers couldn't afford to do anything, and they had an owner who was essentially draining the team dry, trying to keep his own little fiefdom alive. And now there's new ownerships. They are spending like drunken sailors. And now, like the Red Sox, amazingly enough, they get to set the reset button after spending, you know, $200 and some million on contracts, and then they're able to just go, see ya. It's amazing to me that, one, the Dodgers are willing to take on that kind of money, which kind of shows you that baseball teams make a ton of money, especially in a big market like L.A., and two, it's going to be fun to watch Red Sox Nation, maybe stew for a few years as the Red Sox try to rebuild. Because this really shows that the Red Sox, now that they're going to miss the playoffs 3 years in a row, they have decided we cannot win with this group as currently built. They're going to rebuild. So I'm just kind of stunned it actually went down the way it did. So, Greg, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, yeah, this is obviously one of the bigger trades that we've seen in a number of years. I was talking with our old friend Tom Hannon, who runs the baseball page, and Tom, of course, he's born and bred out in Massachusetts, big Red Sox fan, follows the Red Sox very closely, and he said that when it was rumored to be going on a few days ago, when this was first came to light, he said, you know what, if the Red Sox are able to pull this trade off, he says the John Henry family will be dancing in the streets. That was Tom's words. Because of being able to get rid of all these contracts, frankly. You know, Carl Crawford, if you remember, was like the hottest free agent of going.
Yeah,
I know a lot of you know, Tigers fans wanted to see the Tigers go after him, and you know, he was coming off some very impressive years in Tampa, and he was a hot commodity, let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very disappointing in his first season with Boston. Adrian Gonzalez hasn't been disappointing. I mean, his production's been okay, but he hasn't had the impact, I don't think, that in all fairness to him, I mean, it's not all on his shoulders, of course,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, he was supposed – Gonzalez, I'm talking about,
right.
was supposed to be part of the answer over there. That was going to
mm-hmm.
be just another guy that they were going to, you know, add to be another piece to,
yes.
to put them over the hump.
Yeah, he was going to be a cornerstone. He really was.
Yeah, right, and it just hasn't worked out all the time. I mean, they just haven't had, except when they play the Tigers
mm-hmm.
in Boston, they look like world beaters whenever the Tigers play them in Boston. They can't beat anybody in Boston except the Tigers, it seems like. But it seems like that they just, you know, and then Bobby Valentine came in, and you know, I don't know how much of the Bobby Valentine thing had to do with this trade as well. I have no idea. They've missed, of course, David Ortiz. He just came back from the disabled list. They've had, you know, just some issues over there. It just hasn't been a good mix. You know, and then flipping it around, the Dodgers, like you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
you know, under new ownership with the Magic Johnson group, and, you know, obviously, you got to think, too, Al, that the Dodgers haven't won
mm-hmm.
a World Series, haven't been to a World Series, or won one in 24 years.
Yeah.
Since 1988, when Kirk Gibson led them to that upset over the A's.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very long time for that organization. A lot of people talk about the Yankees being, you know, perennially in the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
The Dodgers in the 60s, and well, 50s too, 50s, 60s, and 70s,
right.
as you know, and 80s too, really, were always in the mix. They were always in the playoffs. They were always, you know, winning pennants back in the days before the divisions, winning World Series. You know, this goes back to the days in Brooklyn. And that organization hasn't had a 24-year drought, I can tell you,
mm-hmm.
and probably since the 40s, where they haven't been in a World Series in a quarter of a century.
Yeah.
So that's one of the premier franchises in one of the, you know, in baseball, and they haven't been relevant, frankly, in a long, long time. So this might be another way for the Dodgers as an organization, now that they're out of the shackles of that previous ownership, to say, okay, now we're going to, you know, not that it always works, of course, you know, buying pennants, look what, we just got done talking about the Red Sox and how that backfired on them. But sometimes, Al, when you're in a situation when you might sense an eroding fan base, or you might sense
mm-hmm.
that you are, you know, your window, like right now, they're back, at least in contention again. They got off to a great start. Now they're battling the Giants, just
mm-hmm.
like the old days, for the division. You know, sometimes you got to take a risk and say, you know, we're gonna try this, and we're going to try to inject something. Gonzalez, on the second pitch he faced, he saw, as a Dodger, hit a three-run homer.
Right.
And that doesn't mean that's a great trade. It just means that, you know, that's the kind of thing that sometimes these trades, these guys change teams late in the year, and, you know, before you know it, you know, it can be very impactful. But, you know, clearly this is a salary dump by the Red Sox. They're just, I'm sure, elated
mm-hmm.
to rid themselves of these contracts, which are just bogging them down. And I think that they're probably in a position now where they don't have to totally rebuild. They still got some very good players, Pedroia and Salton Macchia and Ortiz, of course. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, they've still got some talent over there to work with. But clearly they're trying to reload here, and they just dumped a whole lot of salary on the Dodgers.
Yeah, that's the stunning part. And obviously new ownership is trying to I'm not sure what they're trying to do other than trying to spend all this money that market can't afford. Because you're right, this is the Dodgers should be considered like the Yankees when you're talking about a market. That's a team that should be able to spend as much money as they want, considering the income they will have coming in if they if the TV contracts they should be able to get in, obviously making the playoffs. But still, it's still a stunning turn of developments. And one other stunning thing in baseball was another, for the second time in a week, there was a player popped for PEDs. This time it was Bartolo the Clone, the former Cy Young winner, who actually had looked to be, first off, I was surprised that he actually made it back into was still in baseball going into this year, because he had really, once he had hurt his arm a few years ago, he really became a journeyman, and worse than a journeyman. He really bounced around. This year, he had turned it around and become kind of a – he helped the the A's rotation really gelled. They weren't expecting much from him, and he really became a bit of a cornerstone for them. And now it turns out we found out why, that he was essentially used some sort of performance-enhancing drug to help his arm recover or get better or get stronger, however you want to put it. Again, this one doesn't look like it's going to be contested. It looks like Gal Cole is just going to take a suspension and go from there. I guess with this one, Greg, Colon's 39 years old. The way he was pitching this year, he was on his way to earning a nice contract. Considering his age, he was probably going to make a few million. It looks like now with this hanging over his head and that he's going to miss the rest of the regular season, plus I believe either 10 games in the postseason or starting next year if he plays, any team that picks him up now, considering he was a free agent, he's just going to make the bare minimum, if that, because you know he's got that as we that Scarlet S for steroids on him now, and who gets hurt in this whole thing altogether? It's the fans who had bought into the A's and bought into Bartolo Colon's comeback, and now they find out that he's a bit of a fraud.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just don't. You don't know anymore about it. Every time this happens, it just casts another shadow on a cast of bad light.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't want to do, of course, you don't want to, as a fan or as a, even as a media, probably especially as a media person, you don't want to portray such a broad stroke brush and say, well, every time this happens, it just makes me think that they're all doing it. It's just a matter of time before they all get caught. You know, I would hate to get to be that pessimistic or that cynical about it, but it's easy to do because, this is coming on the heels of the Melky Cabrera thing, and this is a very hot-button issue. Especially, it used to be, about other things in baseball, you could start a hot-topic issue, a Hall of Famer,
or
is he a Hall of Famer, is he not, or whatever. Now, the hot-button thing is you want to start a really rousing debate, and then the ballers seeing us talk about PEDs and steroids and who's on it and should these guys be eligible for Hall of Fame and how pervasive is it, and has it turned you off to baseball and everything like that. And I just thankfully so far I still can watch a game and not think about whether or not the guys that I'm watching are on anything. I don't think like that. But when these things happen with Colon and of course with Cabrera, and we're just still off the heels of the whole Canseco thing with all those guys going to trial, McGuire and Clemens and all those guys. It just, and now Lance Armstrong, of course, and bicycling. It just, it really does wear you down. It just kind of pecks away at that wall that you're trying to build around and say, look, these guys are, most of the guys are clean. Only the guys that are being caught are the guys who are on it, as opposed to saying these are just the guys who are caught. Until it's just happening more and more, I'm just going to believe that these are just some bad apples who are stupid enough to try this stuff and stupid enough to put themselves at risk, their careers at risk. I don't know why. I don't know why it's that, how much of an advantage it gives them, they feel, to make all worth it. And I that's the question I have is why.
I guess when it comes down to it is, either they don't want to give up the sport, or it's to get another contract. And I guess those are also kind of intertwined, if you want to go that way. But it's a sad situation, and I hated to see it happen because it really was a nice story. And unfortunately, it's not going to end very well. All right, a few more things about baseball before we wrap up the show, and that would be, let's talk about the Tigers. Drew Smyly is in for Doug Fister and actually pitched very well. He was a big reason why the Tigers were able to take 2-3 from the Angels and have a 6-3 homestand. Smyly was called up to spot start for Fister. Fister's laid up with another injury, unfortunately. This time it's a groin. Smyly pitched very well, went 6 innings, and got the win against the Angels on Saturday night. The Tigers announced today, Jim Leland actually said, they are not going to send Smyly down. They're going to put him in the bullpen as a long reliever. So in this case, a couple things about Smyly, I guess, Greg, is One, I do like the idea of keeping him around just because Pfister's injury history, at least this year anyway, and groins can linger. So there's good reason to keep Smiley around. And also, it also will keep Smiley eligible for the postseason if it comes down to it. You know, he is one of their better arms, and it makes sense to keep their one of their better arms on the team. And I think the most interesting thing about seeing Smiley's emergence this year and how he's pitched in the second half, I looked it up today as I was writing for Bless You Boys, and Smiley has the Tigers have won all three of the starts in the second half, and he has, I think, a 3.18 ERA in those three starts, is that I think his emergence is the reason why the Tigers felt they could deal Jacob Turner, knowing they had Smiley in their pocket. So any thoughts on the emergence of Drew Smiley and also Doug Pfister's groin?
No, I mean, clearly, I mean, you know, anytime there's a groin injury, I get a little bit queasy because, you know, they always seem to start off as minor and they always seem to be nagging and they always seem to just kind of hang around like a, you know, like an unwanted relative spending time at your house. It just seems to just, I've seen it happen in so many, like, you know, in hockey with goalies and, mm-hmm. and not just goalies, with players, the skaters. It just seems like that's a type of injury that it's easy to be fooled into thinking that you're getting better, and then all of a sudden, you know, you tweak it or you mm-hmm. something pops, and you know, I always get the pitcher who moves his that area a lot, and you know, extends himself in that area, and whether it's through his windup or through his delivery or the work mm-hmm. pushing off from his back leg or whatever, you know, clearly you can't, you know, this isn't something you can just shrug off. I mean, you don't go up there and pitch. And frankly, I guess he tweaked it before his last start against Baltimore when the Tigers, you know, staked Pfister to that big lead and then he promptly gave it up. And, you know, maybe partly because he was hurt.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whenever you talk about the groin, I would love to be able to just believe everybody who says, well, it's just one start. He'll be fine his next one. I don't know. I mean, I like to believe that, but I've seen so many groin injuries turn into something that just lingers and sticks mm-hmm. around and just stays with you until you really have, Al, that luxury of rest and rehabilitation, which obviously right now Doug Pfister doesn't have. Mm-hmm. You know, he's too valuable to the Tigers to just say, well, you know, you don't want to shut him down prematurely, but at the other hand, he doesn't have the luxury right now. The games are too important to take three or four starts off and just kind of rest it for 3 or 4 weeks. He doesn't, and then he has to go you got the end of the minor league season, which is next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, any player that's coming back from an injury, there's no place for them to go. It doesn't like the rest of the season where they can go do a minor league rehab thing over in Toledo.
Right.
Next week, that minor league season is over with. That's mm-hmm. why they have the September 1st call-ups. So if you have a coming back from an injury, you've got to come back in either a simulated game or in a big league game.
Right.
And that's just what it is. And so I'm not sold on the fact that this year is going to be just hunky-dory and everything's going to be just fine next time because I don't believe that. Now, as far as Smiley goes, it was very encouraging to see what he did Saturday against the Angels, who had come into Detroit, by the way, on a winning streak, and with their offense pretty much on a roll. He, along with the other two starters over the weekend, really did a good job of handcuffing that Angels lineup. Smiley, I was impressed, Al, with his change of location on his strikeouts. He was getting guys out on breaking balls down and away and down and in. He was getting guys out, striking out on high heat, above the belt, in and out of the strike zone. He really looked like a guy who, you know, was a different kind of a pitcher. I mean, not that he was bad when he first, obviously he got off to a pretty good start in April and May,
mm-hmm.
but he just seems to, Al, have a confidence now about him and a presence where he really looks like a big league pitcher in terms of changing locations, changing speeds, having confidence in the secondary pitches. You know, no more of this deer in the headlight look. I mean, he's really looks like he's in place, not out of place at all in that rotation. That being said, I mean, I want Doug Pfister as healthy as anybody else does.
Oh, yeah.
But if this is what we're going to get from Drew Smiley, this kind of performance, and he's left-handed to boot, that is a huge, he could end up being, believe it or not,
mm-hmm.
an X factor in this whole race.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I guess the only concern is using him out of the bullpen. Smiley said he's not. He says he can get used to it, at least for this year. And he has only actually made one appearance as a pro, as a coming in relief, and that was in 2011 with the Erie Seawolves. But we'll have to see how that goes. But Drew Smiley has been a very impressive pitcher this year, to say the very least. And he has gotten better. He went through a stretch there where he really kind of struggled, say, around June. But since then, he has looked like the guy who was really carried the Tigers for a couple weeks in April. And so, but we're going to stay with the pitching because really that's been the big topic of the Tigers. And next, kind of related to all this, is Hannibal Sanchez. And turns out he might not suck as much as the fan base wanted to believe he did after having a few bad starts. He won in fairly impressive fashion Wednesday, beating Toronto. Tigers won 3-2. Sanchez went 6 2/3, only allowed one earned run. This is the guy I think we all expected the Tigers traded for when he pitched against Toronto. He looked very, very good. And I think as he gets – I think people overestimate – I mean underestimate, pardon me. They underestimate how difficult it is to switch leagues. We saw Prince Fielder get off to a semi-slow start at the plate with the Tigers this year. And now we're seeing it again with Sanchez, who had some issues, had three pretty rough starts in a row, getting himself acclimated to the American League. It is a different style of baseball, and it's a better style of baseball, if you ask me. But when you look at the whole scheme of things, you know, Sanchez now under rotation and Fister getting hurt, this is another one of the reasons why the Tigers had to get an experienced pitcher. Because if they don't have Sanchez – and Fister is hurt, that means they have two rookies in their rotation, and Drew Smiley and Jacob Turner. You're not going to win anything with two rookies in your starting rotation. It just doesn't happen. So to see Sanchez step up his game is going to be huge, and he's going to be an even bigger X factor than Drew Smiley, just because this is the guy who has middle-of-the-rotation talent. This is a guy who should be a number three starter, and he finally pitched like it against Toronto.
Yeah, you know, it's funny we're talking about guys who could be key. I already mentioned Smiley being an ex-statue. You talked about Sanchez being a key guy. That's what's so fun about a pennant race is when you get down to this kind of time of the season when you've got less than 40 games to play and the games become so important in their scope. And so what we do is as we talk about the teams, we tend to put the spotlight on so many players. I mean, we talk about so many players as being potentially key. And what it really says, Al, is that everybody on your 25-man roster right now has to dig deep down and find something, whether you're a guy who plays twice a week or whether you're a guy who plays every day, you got to bring something to the table and do something to help your team win. And, you know, even though, you know, I said on my website, GregHedo.com, that I don't think that whether the Tigers win the division is going to rest on the shoulders of Hannibal Sanchez. And what I meant by that is I still think it's going to be other players who are going to have more of an impact. But to get down, the truth of the matter really is that everybody, when called upon, has to – this is the time now where everybody has to produce, whether you're the fifth starter of the rotation, whether you're a rookie in the rotation, whether you're a Quinton Bailey-type player, whether you're Brennan Bosch, whether you're Delman Young, whether you're Miguel Cabrera, everybody right now has to bring it. And because I tell you what, the White Sox are bringing it. That's the thing. The White Sox are getting, just like the Tigers did in 2011, they're getting years out of players that they probably weren't expecting and they may never get again. The guys like Rios and Pierzynski, who seems to be getting better with age, done, even though his batting average is low, it's just hitting, you know, he's got almost 40 home runs, for goodness sake. There's Ramirez. I mean, there's a lot of guys, Gordon Beckham, Flowers, a lot of guys for Chicago who are getting it done right now. And that's what you need. And that's why when you make these preseason prognostications, you know, I forgive people who say the Tigers, all those 50 people, 50 out of 50, whatever it was, who said the Tigers were going to win the division. And I forgive all those people, myself included, because it's hard to go out there and say, well, the guys who had the years in 2011 aren't going to have them in 2012. That's It's hard to say that.
Right.
And it's just, and it's also hard to say, to look at the White Sox roster at the beginning of the year with a rookie manager and say, okay, I feel it in my bones, you're going to see a career year out of Alexi Ramirez. You're going to see a career year out of Alex Reels. You're going to see A.J. Pierzynski hit a career, shatter his career high in home runs. Shatter it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Adam Dunn's going to bounce back and hit 40 home runs. I think Chris Sale is going to be this dynamic rookie lefty pitcher. Well, you know, Mike, I want to meet the guy who predicted all that stuff, because I want to play the lottery with that guy.
Yeah.
Because you just can't predict that kind of stuff. It's silly. Conversely, it's easier to predict. Well, I think that we'll get 15 to 20 home runs out of Alex Avila. I think we'll get 15 to 20 home runs out of Brendan Bosch. I think we'll get some RBIs out of Delmon Young. I think we'll get this out of this person, this out of that person. Well, guess what? It really hasn't happened. We're 130 games into the season just about, and a lot of those guys haven't done what we thought.
Yeah.
Conversely, a lot of guys on the White Sox are doing things that nobody thought was possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I think that's a good way to put it. There's no way in the hell AJ Pierzynski is gonna top this season. He's not that good of a player. He's having a career year, and you're saying it with some of the other players. And I guess it also brings that you make a good point with guys that aren't necessarily stars, or guys that aren't considered to be cornerstones, need to step up their game. We saw that on Saturday. When the much maligned 5-9 part of the Tigers lineup had 10 hits and really was the entire offense in the win. And we're also seeing that, Greg, from Max Scherzer. He's putting up Verlander-like numbers in the second half of the season, and he did it again today, going 7 innings, striking out 9. He set a new Tigers record of having 8 consecutive games of 8 strikeouts or more. He's got 14 wins on a year, and say what you will about wins that they're based on luck, which we know, because Justin Verlander has outpitched pretty much everybody in the American League and only has 12 wins. But
right.
Max Scherzer has really we were debating this on the Bless You Boys podcast. As Max Scherzer stepped up and become a number two starter, you know, a top of the rotation guy, and we were debating, you know, is he like a he's not so much one B to Verlander's 1A. I think he's more like 2B compared to Doug Fister's 2A. But the way he's pitching right now, Greg, he's pitching like an ace. And if anybody can, could you picture, say, if this team is healthy and they continue to pitch in the way they are, and they make the postseason, could you picture trying to face a three-man rotation of Justin Verlander, Doug Fister, and Max Scherzer? That is, I don't think there's a better three-man punch, at least pitching, when they're all on, as they have in the second half. There's nothing better than that in baseball.
No, and Scherzer, he's won, you mentioned 14 games, a very quiet 14 wins. I mean, he has a chance, Al, to win 20 games.
Yes, he does.
If he can, he's got a And then you win 20 games, you lead the league in strikeouts. You know, you think you get some Cy Young consideration? I mean,
not a one.
He probably won't, because his ERA isn't low enough. But
right.
The fact of the matter is, he has enough starts left. Scherzer does to win 20 games. Yes, he has to get a little lucky. And yes, Verlander, he won 24 games last year and is on pace to win 16 or 17 this year. But you're right, his ERA is still 2.5.
Yeah.
He pitched a great game, against Toronto last week, and the Tigers came back and won that game. You know, Scherzer is the thing that's great about those guys, and Fister and Scherzer and Verlander, is that the best way to wiggle yourself out of a jam, of course, is with a strikeout, because it's like getting it out without the ball being put into play, which means there's no chance for the runners to advance. It's a great way to just, you know, to quell a rally or to just get a big out, and that's what Scherzer can do. He's got that strikeout ability, as does Verlander, as does Fister to a degree. These are guys that can, you know, when they need a strikeout, can get it, and just overpowering, you know, hitters. Scherzer Sunday was brilliant, and he's struck out eight guys or more in eight consecutive starts, which puts him in some sort of company along with Newhouser.
Hal Newhouser, exactly.
And before that, in the earlier days of the Tigers, puts him in that kind of company. You know, this is. Yeah, but when you're pitching under the shadow of Verlander, you're not going to get, obviously, the publicity. But, hey, he's 14-6.
Yep.
But the thing that's nice, too, about this, Al, what's encouraging is this is the longest stretch we've seen in quite some time, ever, as a Tiger, of shedding that role of being inconsistent.
Right.
You know, he's going out there right now, Al, and he's pitching like he's... Like, he's an ace. Like, he's the number one guy. And we haven't seen a stretch like this from Max in a long time, where he's gone out there every single start. And you know, you almost don't have to worry anymore about him going out there and laboring through a 110-pitch, five-inning start like he had in the past. The problem with Max, I'm not saying it's a problem, but the thing about Max is I was watching the game Sunday, and at one point he retired, I believe, 14 Angels in a row.
14
but his,
right.
But his pitch count was still elevated. I mean, in the sixth inning, he passed 100 pitches in the sixth inning.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, how can a guy who's only given up one run through six innings and has retired this many guys in a row, why is his pitch count, you know, kind of a little bit high?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the strikeouts,
right.
He obviously he pitches a lot, throws a lot of pitches to guys because – you know, they're following him off, and he's pitching, he's throwing five or six pitches to guys to get them out. You know, he eventually does strike them out a lot, but he's having to use five to six, seven pitches on these hitters to get them out, and that's a negative to a strikeout pitcher, because how many times does a guy strike somebody out on three pitches? Obviously, it takes usually five or six pitches to strike a guy out.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're striking out as many banners as Scherzer is, he's got almost 200 strikeouts, you're going to throw a lot of pitches. So even though Max was, you know, his pitching line was great, his pitch count, which I know we can debate that, but I mean, let's face it, it is used a lot to determine whether or not you're going to leave him in or not. This was a little high today, Sunday, even though he did last seven innings. But he had to, he threw like almost 120 pitches just to get through those seven innings. But like I say, in the sixth inning, he was at 102.
Yeah.
So that's just part of the deal with Max Scherzer. That's just what you're going to, he's not going to be a complete game guy, a complete game machine like Verlander. You know, he doesn't have those 8-9 pitch innings like Verlander does. And Verlander's a strikeout pitcher, but Verlander can get guys out by pitching to contact as well. And Scherzer's best when he's striking guys out.
Yeah, exactly. And it's and as you said, yeah, that's why Scherzer has yet to have a complete game in his major league career, and who knows if he'll ever get it. But if he gives you seven innings like he did today, I'm not going to worry about it. And with that, we're running a little long, so let's wrap things up, Greg. So time for our Jerk of the Week, where someone's bugging us. We're going to call them out. And I know you let off last week, so I guess it's my honors. I could go several different ways. I was thinking about going to Skip Bayless, who complained about he just threw it out there that maybe Derek Jeter's on PEDs, even though there's no evidence to the contrary. But I decided to go with Dez Bryant of the Dallas Cowboys. And this is the guy who is essentially the Cowboys have put him on the old double secret probation. He has these restrictions, Greg. He's been given a midnight curfew. If he's going to miss curfew, he needs to notify the Dallas Cowboys. No drinking alcohol. He can't attend any strip clubs and can only attend nightclubs if they are approved by the Cowboys. He must attend counseling. He has a rotating three-man security team, and one of them will be with Bryant at all times. And one member of the security team will drive Bryant to practices, games, and team functions. Are they going to wipe his ass, too, when he goes to the bathroom? My God! That just kind of goes to show, Greg, just how amazingly irresponsible some athletes are, and that he literally needs to be babysat 24-7 to get through a football season is He should be ashamed of himself, and I hope his mother gives him a good talking to. So just for being a guy who can't control his base impulses, and the Cowboys are going to have to do it for him, my jerk of the week is Dez Bryant.
I thought you were going to go for a second that guy who left Miguel Cabrera isn't in the top five of the MVP.
Oh, yeah, Keith Law with the – yeah, because we might get into that next week, Greg.
Yeah, I hope we do because I have a lot to say about that. But I'm going to go with some relatively low-hanging fruit. That would be one Ken Hawk Harrelson, the Chicago White Sox, the TV play-by-play guy, who once again got himself in some hot water. If you recall, early in the year, Harrelson had to apologize publicly because he went off on a rant against one of the umpires, and so much so that he was almost shamed into apologizing. Well, on Saturday, Robin Ventura and A.J. Fusinski were kicked out of the game against Seattle because arguing balls and strikes with one plate umpire. I can't remember the umpire's name. And Harrelson, of course, went off. I read some of the things that he said on the air, and he called the umpire awful on several occasions. He said that this is the kind of performance that's going to be sent to the league office. And he said, look, he's got a big strike zone for the Mariners pitchers. He's got a 10-inch strike zone for the White Sox pitchers. And I'm thinking to myself, pal, the White Sox don't need any help right now. They're doing just fine. Don't try to tell me that they're getting jobbed by the umpires, because they're doing just fine. But it's not even that. It's just that Harrelson just takes the whole Homer thing to a whole different level when it comes to a play-by-play guy. He just comes off as a buffoon. If you read this, Google Hawk Harrelson and see what he said Saturday about the umpire in the game again between them, which, by the way, the White Sox won. It's just ridiculous, and it just comes off sounding like a crybaby and a whiny fan. So my jerk of the week is Ken Harrelson.
That always flies in my book, Greg. That guy is an embarrassment to Major League Baseball. He's already been, as you mentioned, he's been called on the carpet once this year, and at this rate, it's going to happen again. And someone's got to put their thumb down on that guy. But unfortunately, it won't be the White Sox. All right, let's wrap up the podcast. As always, we're running long, so. Greg, if you could, as you do so well, could you please get out the thank yous, plugs, and where they can find us online?
Sure. Thanks, of course, to Mick McCabe. Wonderful talking to Mick. So knowledgeable about what he does for a living, and it was a lot of fun talking to Mick, so we appreciate that. Also, a reminder, everybody, that next week we'll be joined by Adam Biggers for Adam Rant on Labor Day, a week from tonight, September the 2nd. We'll be talking to – or September the 3rd, actually, sorry. We'll be talking to Adam Biggers for Adam Rants. Keep your eye out on Facebook, facebook.com/TheKneeJerks, Twitter, twitter.com/TheKneeJerks, or Twitter, actually it's Twitter, it's TheKneeJerks.info also, or @TheKneeJerks, and our blog is TheKneeJerks.us, shortcut there to find out what's going on with the program. Just click on any one of those social media sites and you'll find out what's going on with the show. Read me at GregHino.com if you would every day. I'd appreciate that. And I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon. And thank you, Big Al, for making Monday night so gosh darn fun.
As well, thank you as well, Greg, to take time from your busy schedule to talk a little sports. As always, you can find me at WayneFonts.com, Wayne Fonts Experience, BlessYouBoys.com, Bless You Boys, the Detroit Tigers blog, Crispy Nation, and always be on the lookout for the Bless You Boys podcast, which can be found pretty much at the end of every week on Bless You Boys and on the usual places where you find podcasts such as iTunes and the like, as well as where you can find this one, this podcast as well. And of course, you can find me on Twitter. Use the shortcut, BigAl.us. With that, we'll call it an evening. So until next week at this time, this is Al Beaton saying good night, good luck, and aloha.
Ciao, everybody. We'll see you next week. Good night.